Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs today. Today's Veterans Day. We are going to be dealing with a lot of the veterans' bills. And I'm going to do something a little unusual. I'm going to open up almost all of the bills, because I want all of the members to be able to give their testimony, the legislators. And so I'm going to start out with that. And even though we're a subcommittee right now, the other members are planning to be here. But I do want those people on record. So with that, I am going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 449, Senate Bill 608, HJM 2, HJM 4, and HJR 10. And with that...
Let me just summarize those for you, Madam Chair.
I have the witness sheet.
Senate Bill 449 provides that U.S. Highway 97 in Oregon shall be known as the World War II Veterans Historic Highway. Senate Bill 606 directs the Oregon Military Department and Department of Veteran Affairs to create information campaigns on certain mental and physical disorders affecting veterans. HJM 2 urges Congress to enact legislation assisting veterans' employment. HJM 4 urges Congress to pass legislation and approve funds for transition of National Guard and reservists to civilian life following active service. And HJR 10 declares March 2009 as American Legion Month.
Okay, let's start with Senator Farioli on Senate Bill 449.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, Senator Ted Farioli, District 30. Madam Chairman and members, thank you for holding the hearing. I'll try to be as brief as possible because I think the far more interesting testimony will follow. 449 is a very simple, yet I think important enactment. It provides that U.S. Highway 97 in Oregon shall be known as the World War II Veterans Historic Highway. The reason I think that is a very sensible and reasonable designation is that U.S. 97 saw tremendous service in World War II and played a significant role in the U.S. War effort. It served 8 critical World War II military training bases along its entire length from Biggs Junction to Klamath Falls. And military training sites existed at Rufus, Madras, Redmond, Prineville, Bend, Sun River, and Klamath Falls. And today, none of these sites really, or at least 97, is not marked to commemorate the service and the sacrifice made by World War II veterans. If we designated the World War II Veterans Historic Highway, portions of 97 would be eligible for the placement of appropriate and suitable monuments. And those signs would inform folks of the role that some of those training facilities played in World War II. For instance, Camp Abbott was the site where 90,000 Army combat engineers were trained and served as the headquarters of the Oregon Maneuver, which was a tremendous push during World War II. Pilots trained at the Bend Airport from 1942 to 1945. There was a USO organization, a couple of Army hospitals there, and an officer housing complex. Army combat engineers trained at Camp Rufus near Biggs, and they trained there for the crossing of the Rhine River. So that was, a key element of the success in Europe. The Redmond Army Airfield was used to train P-38, P-39, and B-17 pilots and other pilots for World War II. Madras Army Air Base also trained P-38 and B-17 pilots. And as a matter of fact, several World War II hangars on the main runway are still in use today. Prineville's airport was built for civilian pilot training and also trained U.S. Navy N-3N aircraft pilots. Of course, the Klamath Naval Air Station is still in service today, still a key part of America's Western defense. There was a Marine Recuperation Barracks, which was housed there and primarily used to help people recover from tropical diseases. And of course, the 173rd Fighter Wing of the Oregon Air National Guard still operates F-15 fighter aircraft at the Kingsley Field facility. There are so many other contributions that were made that centered along the 97 corridor. It seems totally appropriate that we allow this to move forward, particularly because the way the bill is constructed, it's primarily the veteran services organizations that will pay for and help locate the signage. The bill authorizes the Department of Transportation to facilitate that, but it'll primarily be an expression of pride by local veterans organizations and local communities. So it really does empower the community to honor the World War II veterans and the services that happened along that Highway 97, 126 corridor.
Thank you. Questions? Would you and Senator Whitsitt be willing to carry the bill?
Oh, absolutely, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. With that, I'll call Senator Whitsitt. Thank you, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Doug Whitsitt. I represent Senate District 28. I think Senator Farioli has pretty well characterized the installations along the Highway 97. There were over 10,000 men and women that served in World War II that originated, lived in the counties that Highway 97 traverses. One of the things that Senator Farioli did not mention was that there are three sites along Highway 97 that commemorate the Medal of Honor winners, those that have earned the Medal of Honor. And one of those is that where the 97 crosses the Crooked River, the high bridge there is named in commemoration of Lieutenant Rex T. Barber, who was the pilot who, P-38 pilot, who shot down the bomber that carrying Admiral Yamamoto, who was the architect of the Pearl Harbor disaster. The second is a highway bridge near Bend that is named for Robert Maxwell. Bob Maxwell is still alive. He was somewhere in France defending a forward communications site and threw his body on a live hand grenade, which went off, and he survived it, and he's alive today. In fact, he may be in the room today. I didn't see him. And Kingsley Field is named in memory of David Kingsley, who was in a B-17 over Belgium when it sustained damage that caused it to crash. The bombardier was severely wounded. Lieutenant Kingsley took off his parachute, put it on the bombardier, and helped him out of the plane. And Lieutenant Kingsley died in the plane. That's how it became Kingsley Field. I think this is really a great idea. Our World War II veterans are dying at a pretty rapid rate now. They're all that age. And I think it's the time to do this. And I would really appreciate it if you could see your way to move this bill forward quickly. Thank you.
Thank you. And would you be willing to co-carry that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I'd like to call up Representative Wisnett and Representative Stiegler.
Such a gentleman.
Yes.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Judy Stigler, State Representative from District 54, which is the city of Bend and a little bit south down into Deschutes River Woods. So it's a mouthful when you have to say that fast. At any rate, I am a co-sponsor of this piece of legislation. When I was approached to be a co-sponsor and to support this legislation, to me, in the words of my 25-year-old daughter, it was a no-brainer. I looked at this from two perspectives, from an educational, as an educational opportunity, and also as an opportunity to restore some lost history. This nation is full of missed opportunities when it comes to capturing our history and teaching the next generations about what happened before them. As a longtime education advocate, I embrace any and every opportunity I can to bring history home to our children, to our grandchildren. We do a good job, and we've done a good job in this country about things such as the Revolution, the Civil War, maybe, you know, a few things beyond that. But our more recent history, and it is our history, I mean, it, things that come before us, that's part of who we are. We haven't done as good a job about educating our children and providing opportunities for them to learn. And I, being a longtime Central Oregon resident and having a husband who comes from Klamath Falls and having contacts throughout that Central Oregon, that 97 corridor, when I was given the list of the various and sundry connections with training sites, with airfields, with the historical connection to our World War II veterans, I was frankly myself quite educated. I knew about some of these sites, and particularly the ones closer to home like Camp Abbott. But I was frankly astounded by the breadth of the historical nature of a lot of that area. I think people think we're sort of out in the middle of nowhere and there wasn't much that ever happened or went on out there. And so I looked at this again as an opportunity to provide some educational opportunities and to recapture that lost history. The other thing that was remarkable about this piece of legislation is not only was it promoted by veterans associations, but they came to us rather than just with their handout and said, here, we want to do this, do it for us. They came with a solution of how to do it. And I think those are very rare opportunities in this day and age. People ask a lot of government. It's a rare situation where not only do they, what essentially they're asking us to do is to help them achieve something, and they've got the plan of how to get there. So, again, I support this wholeheartedly from an educational, history buff, and I love to see those opportunities. I many opportunities, my children and I, we'd always take a summer trip after school let out, and we purchased the Smithsonian Guides to Historical America and plotted our trips around those guides, and they were part of that, and they were always road trips, and it was a very not only entertaining way, but a very, I believe, very educational way to, you know, to take a vacation and to have some good quality family time with my children. So, you know, this fits right in with what I think we value in this country, which is providing that link between the past and the present. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stigler.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Gene Wisnett, District 53. Thank you for hearing these bills. I didn't get a chance to check them all. I think I'm sponsoring all these bills, and I appreciate the work that this committee is doing, how important it is. I would start off by, I always like to quote from George Washington, who says, the willingness with which our young people are likely to serve in any war, no matter how justified, shall be directly proportionate to how they perceive the veterans of earlier wars were treated and appreciated by their nation. George Washington, I think that was his farewell address. So I'll only be speaking on Senate Bill 449 and House Joint Resolution 10, Madam Chair. But again, I see in the audience today, and I appreciate all the work that Mr. Willis, General Caldwell, have done for veterans in this and working with this committee, and I appreciate what they have done. I think we've made some, since I've been in the building, I'm proud of what we've done, and I hope that will continue with this session. As Representative Stigler said, this bill 449 was brought to us by a friend, Dick Tobiasen. Dick has been a real advocate for veterans in Central Oregon, and I think this is important, and we want to do this, but also we must remember plaques and naming highways are important for that memory, but we also need to find treatment and other ways to care for our veterans. So I support 449. I live probably a mile by, as a crow flies, from Highway 97. Senator Bates and I have homes that are a couple of miles away from Camp Abbott, and we think that this is a good recognition for veterans. But let's also try to find some money for health services and other services for our veterans. Madam Chair, on House Joint Resolution 10 was brought to me by friends from our Representative Stigler in my district for the American Legion resolution, and this is an important. The American Legion, the bill acknowledges March 2009 as American Legion Month. The American Legion will celebrate its 90th birthday. It was chartered in March of 1990 by Congress, and in September 1919 as a patriotic wartime organization. You're going to hear testimony, but I think all of us know how important this organization is in helping our veterans and our communities. I think we probably all have American Legion posts. If you didn't know, they were also responsible for the original GI Bill that enabled millions of veterans to obtain education, home loans. It was responsible for creating the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. I attended Boys States. I don't know of any Boys State and Girls State. It's a big American Legion program. And I think on the staff summary sheet, you'll see some other great programs that the American Legion has done in the nation. Locally in Oregon, there's 25,000 Legionnaires belonging to 120 posts. They have over 10,000 auxiliary members. So I think this is a great recognition, and I'd urge you to pass both bills, and I hope we can get the expedite House Joint Resolution 10 since this is the month of March, so we can recognize
this. Yes, quickly.
Thank you very much to you and the committee members.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Senator Schrader? Yes, I've opened all of them. So you can speak to all of them,
Thank
Senator
you.
Schrader.
Well, thank you, colleagues. As you know, I've always been a big supporter of veterans.
Introduce yourself.
Pardon me? Oh, I'm Senator Martha Schrader from Clackamas County, and it's nice to be here with all of you this morning. I am here to testify in the particular on three of the bills, and that is House Joint Memorial 2, 4, and Senate Bill 606. And I'd like to start with House Joint Memorial 2. I believe that a lot of the skills that our military folks have learned in the process of serving us have immediate transferability to civilian life, and I also believe that we can't allow these skills to go unused, particularly in today's economic climate, the economy as a whole, and veterans in specific can't afford not to use all of their valuable skills that they have learned while defending our country. If we don't capture these skills for productive economic use, our economy will suffer. We will have higher unemployment, which is already a problem among veterans, and we will obviously have a less dynamic economy, less productive economy. This memorial, in my estimation, is a win for all parties involved, and when Congress enacts these proposals, it will be the key for so many veterans transitioning back into our workforce. HJM 2 is important because we can add our voice to the rising chorus of those who know that if we overlook a single veteran's economic plight, we are hindering both that veteran and our economy as a whole. So I think that this bill in particular, I believe, was also a result of the Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services, of which I had the honor to serve on that task force. House Joint Memorial 4 is fundamentally a fairness issue. When called up, our National Guard is asked to do the same duties as those in other services. And yet, when they get out from the same combat zones, they are actually treated somewhat differently. Currently, National Guard members have 10 demobilization days, and regular armed forces have 90 to 120 days to demobilize. This allows for additional career training, psychological and social preparation, and a chance to decompress when people have gone through similar situations. I believe it is incumbent upon all of us, as the people who represent these state militiamen and women, to advocate for their cause. Without this memorial, we are derelict in our duty to represent those recently returned combat veterans. Our deliberative body is entrusted to represent the people of Oregon fairly, and if we do not advocate for Congress to show the same fairness to our and every other state's National Guard, I think that we will have let them down. From my experience working with Camp Withicum, I would say that these demobilization pieces are probably the most critical things that we have to deal with when people return, in particular because we're facing such a large number of our folks going, I guess the largest number since World War II, making sure that when they return that they have the appropriate services is going to be essential for their health and well-being and the health and well-being of their families. Finally, I just would like to say a few words about Senate Bill 606. I did pull up some data from the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics National Death Index, and this actually speaks, I think, to some of the mental health issues that folks have when they return and when they've experienced trauma and combat situations. The data showed that female veterans are twice as likely to commit suicide as the general population, and male veterans are two-thirds as likely to commit suicide as the general population. And in his testimony, James V. Peek, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, testified before the United States House Committee on Veteran Affairs on May 6, 2008. The department will continue to educate its employees throughout its continuing employee education process to identify those at possible risk of suicide to ensure that they get proper care. As new data on suicide rates, risk factors for suicide, and regional variations will become available, the VA will use the data to refine its programs and to better evaluate their level of success. We here in this state must do the same to ensure that our employees are similarly educated. And not only are we seeing increased, upon occasion, suicide rates, the families are traumatized. They are having a number of issues that they have to deal with related to mental health and domestic violence issues, and PTSD. I think we're all aware of those kinds of things that are happening as folks return home. And I do support this bill, as I know all of you do, because it's essential that we meet these needs when our folks get back. So,
and I was horrified, really, to read, I think it was Sunday's Oregonian, or I forget which, the article regarding the Oregon Guard that was exposed to something beginning with CHL, Clorox.
Yes, absolutely.
And hopefully when we have the Department of Veterans Affairs, we will have them up here to talk about what they are doing to try to track down some of these vets.
And I do know that particular veteran actually did visit with Congressman Schrader recently and expressed his concern in Washington, D.C. So we're seeing, I hope, this information at all levels of government. And I also was aware of that article, Senator, and it's a large concern for all of us, exposure to chemicals and other materials in the field.
So. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. With that, we have, I don't see Senator Boquist, but Senator Schrader, would you be willing to carry HJM 2 and HJM 4?
With pleasure.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
With that, for the time being, I will close Senate Bill 606, HJM 2, HJM 4, and HJR 10, and we're going to focus on Senate Bill 449. And who, does it matter who comes first? I think it's, is it Steve West, Dick Tobiasen, and Stella Austin?
We don't have any opponents, so it's kind of easy.
Yeah. Oops, no, I didn't do that one. Thinking WizNet. I saw the W. Okay.
This one.
love technology when it works.
And introduce yourself for the committee also.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senators, and committee staff. For the record, my name is Steve West. I am a former Klamath County Commissioner. I'm also a registered lobbyist in the state of Oregon, but today I'm here as a volunteer, volunteering for something that I'm actually very passionate about. I'm honored to be joined this morning by retired Brigadier General Starl Austin. He's a World War II P-47 combat pilot, and retired Lieutenant Colonel Dick Tobiasen, who is a Vietnam combat pilot. There's several reasons that I volunteered to help with this bill. The first is that two men that are my heroes, Bob Maxwell, a World War II Medal of Honor winner, and Jack Sherman, who's a highly decorated veteran of the 101st Airborne in World War II. Considering the sacrifice those men have made for our country, they're hard men to say no to. The second reason is that my father was a World War II combat veteran. My father-in-law was a three-war Marine. They're both gone, but I think they'd want me to be here today doing this. And thirdly, the most important reason for me is I'm not a veteran. And because I'm not a veteran, I believe that I have a greater responsibility to the men and women of this country who are veterans to do everything I can to do to support them. SB 449 is a very simple bill. It provides for the honorary designation of Highway 97 as the World War II Veterans Historic Highway. Basically, what that does is it allows some signage. It does nothing to negatively impact the Blue Star Memorial Highway program. It does nothing to change the official name of the highway. And it does nothing to impact anyone's address or maps. And perhaps the most wonderful thing about this bill, it may be the only bill you see this session that doesn't want any taxpayer money. In fact, we wrote into the bill, you're not allowed to give us any money. So I hope that that's, y'all deserve a break. and I hope that this bill provides that for you. I'm going to now defer to my two colleagues to provide the bulk of our testimony.
Thank you, Steve. Chairman Monis Anderson and Vice Chairman Cruz and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dick Tobias, and I'm a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, a Vietnam combat veteran, two tours. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I am here representing the U.S. Highway 97 World War II Veterans Historic Highway Committee. Other committee members include, who you've already heard of, World War II Medal of Honor Robert D. Maxwell, Lee Flagel, who is a U.S. Air Force Korean War veteran, John Sherman, U.S. Army 101st Airborne Division World War II combat veteran, Jerry Barnes from the Korean and Vietnam War, and his former state legislator, and retired Brigadier General Starl Austin, who Steve introduced as a World War II combat pilot and former Assistant Adjutant General of the Oregon National Guard. Steve is our very able assistant here, volunteering, as you heard, to handle our liaison here in Salem. Senate Bill 449 was introduced by Senator Doug Whitsett at the request of our committee. We are grateful to Senator Whitsett and all 18 co-sponsors for their bipartisan support. This legislation would provide U.S. Highway 97 to be given the designation as the World War II Veterans Historic Highway. This is a regional honor, and as such will not change the highway's official name, any maps, or any addresses. It will not adversely impact any statewide efforts to honor all of Oregon's World War II veterans. Perhaps most importantly, and especially in our current time, it will not require any taxpayer dollars. Instead, it is funded entirely through private donations, and there are many waiting to do that. So where is Highway 97? In Oregon, U.S. Highway 97 is officially named the Dalles to California Highway and runs approximately 286 miles north-south from Biggs on the Columbia River to the Oregon-California line 26 miles south of Klamath Falls. U.S. Highway 97 forms a major north-south transportation corridor that serves six rural Oregon counties along the east side of the Cascade Mountains. It is also designated Blue Star Memorial Highway. Neither the official name of the U.S. Highway 97 nor the Blue Star designation would be changed by SB 449. So why designate Highway 97 as a World War II Veterans Historic Highway? U.S. Highway 97 is very unique in its connection to Oregon's contribution to World War II. During World War II, U.S. Highway 97 provided for important north-south movement of men and materials, as well as serving 8 strategic military training facilities in the Oregon maneuver area. From 1942 to 1946, these facilities were used by the Army Air Force, the Navy, and the U.S. Marine Corps. All the military services we had during World War II were located there. There were 8 facilities sited east of the Cascades because of the proximity to U.S. Highway 97 and the north-south connectivity it provided, as well as the availability of large expanses of open terrain, public land, and weather conditions typical of combat areas. Both individuals and entire units trained at these facilities would go on to serve in the Pacific and Europe, Africa, and Middle East theaters of operation during World War II. Let's talk about the Oregon Maneuver. In 1943, the Oregon Maneuver area, some 8 million acres of public land and private lands located in 7 Oregon counties east of the Cascades and served by U.S. 97, hosted a 3-month training exercise. Over 100,000 soldiers from the 3 Army Infantry Divisions and their associated support units were trained at what has become known as the Oregon Maneuver. All 3 infantry divisions, the 104th, the 96th, and the 91st, were activated at Camp Adair, Oregon, what is now the city of Adair Village, and the E.E. Wilson State Wildlife Area just north of Corvallis, Oregon. The Oregon Maneuver was the largest military training exercise in the Pacific Northwest, ever, of its kind. Let's start with looking at each facility. U.S. Army Camp Rufus. In December 1944, the small town of Rufus, population of 90, swelled in size with the arrival of 1,000 U.S. Army soldiers. Known as Camp Rufus, it would grow to an encampment of over 2,500. The men of the 1687th Combat Engineer Battalion, the 558th Heavy Pontoon Bridge Engineers, and the 149th Engineer Maintenance Company would use the nearby Columbia River to train and perfect techniques to use for crossing the Rhine River into Germany. U.S. Army Airfield at Madras was located near the junction of U.S. Highway 26 and U.S. Highway 97. This facility was used to train pilots for Lockheed P-38 Lightning fighters, Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress bombers, as well as other aircraft. 2 large hangars were built to house maintenance equipment and personnel. Today, the World War II hangars are still in use as the main runway for general aviation aircraft. In Prineville, we had civilian pilot training. A new airport complete with a hangar and administration building was built in Prineville to support civilian pilot training. Sterile Austin is a product of civilian pilot training. From 1943 through 1944, the program was operated there by military contractors using Navy N-3 biplanes. 2 barracks were also built in Prineville to house student pilots. Graduate pilots were sent on to U.S. Army flying schools. Portions of the World War II runway and a hangar are still in use. The World War II office building remained in use for 62 years after the war before being replaced in October of 2007. The barracks built to house the pilot trainees were used for about 40 years after the war, first by Prineville's Police Department and City Clerk, and later moved to the fairgrounds and used by the local 4-H Club. Today, Prineville Airport is home to Les Schwab's corporate aircraft and other general aviation aircraft. Redmond. U.S. Army Airfield at Redmond was located just east of 97 and was also used to train fighter pilots and bombing pilots, B-17s and P-38s being the aircraft of choice. The other airplanes were involved there. The list is very long. Today, that airfield is known as Roberts Field. It serves both general aviation and commercial carriers in Central Oregon. Both World War II runways and 1 World War II aircraft hangar remain in use today. Lance Air International Incorporated, builder of award-winning high-performance general aviation aircraft, has a manufacturing facility at Roberts Field. The Department, the USDA's Department of Forest Service also has its Redmond Air Center at Roberts Field. In Bend, we also had civilian pilot training. In 1942, a group of patriotic citizens banded together to deed a small piece of farmland to the city of Bend for the express purpose that a municipally owned and operated landing strip be established. The site was developed to include a runway, 2 hangars, and additional support buildings. From 1942 through 1945, what today is known as the Bend Municipal Airport, was used to train pilots through the Civilian Pilot Training Program. A U.S. Army hospital, a housing complex, and vehicle repair facility were also built in Bend. Today, in addition to serving as a general aviation airfield, Cessna Aircraft, Windward Performance, and Epic Aircraft all have aircraft manufacturing facilities at Bend Municipal Airport. Camp Abbott. Camp Abbott was located about 15 miles south of Bend, was a state site for training of combat engineers with 90,000 trainees completing the program. The camp was commanded by Colonel Frank Besson. I happen to work for his son, who was a four-star general. In 1943, Camp Abbott was also served as headquarters for the three-month-long Oregon Maneuver. Today, Camp Abbott is the community of Sun River. What is known today as the Great Hall at the Sun River Resort was originally built as the Camp Abbott Officers Club. One of the U.S. Army chapels at Camp Abbott was moved to Prineville and remains in use today as a church. The Naval Air Station at Klamath Falls. In 1942, Klamath Falls Municipal Airport was chosen to become the site of U.S. Naval Air Station Klamath Falls to provide combat training for fleet squadrons in the Pacific Theater of Operations. Pilots used nearby Clear Lake, just over the California border south of Klamath Falls, to practice torpedo bombing runs. The airport functioned as a U.S. Naval Air Station from 1942 to 1946. Today, the airfield is known as Klamath Falls Airport Kingsley Field and serves both general aviation and commercial aviation, as well as the Forest Service fire retardant bomber facility. Kingsley Field is also home of the Oregon Air National Guard 173rd Fighter Wing. At Klamath Falls, we had a second facility. It was called the Marine Corps Barracks and Hospital. Thousands of Marines filled up the new facilities brought there to recuperate from tropical disease that they had contracted fighting in the hellholes of the Pacific. From 1944 through 1946, the facilities were operated as a parasitic disease rehabilitation center. In 1947, the facilities became the campus of Oregon Technical Institute, which was founded to provide education opportunities for returning World War II servicemen and women. Today, part of the Oregon University System, OIT, is the only fully accredited polytechnic university in the Pacific Northwest. Seven of these eight facilities after World War II were used to provide the foundation for important post-war transportation, government services, and education infrastructure developed for the region. They continue in that role today, providing important services to the citizens of this region. U.S. Highway 97 also has strong connections to other regional memorials honoring Oregon's World War II veterans. The Oregon 2003 legislature passed Senate Joint Resolution 38, naming the new U.S. Highway 97 bridge over the Crooked River the Rex T. Barber Veterans Memorial Bridge to honor Lieutenant Rex Barber, a Culver native, for his singular role in April 18, 1944, of shooting down the military aircraft carrying Japanese Admiral Yamamoto, the architect of the infamous attack on Pearl Harbor. In 2004, the Deschutes County named its bridge on County Route 5042, the Robert D. Maxwell Veterans Memorial Bridge, to honor World War II Medal of Honor recipient Robert D. Maxwell of Bend and veterans. Klamath Falls Airport, Kingsley Field, is named in honor of World War II U.S. Army pilot Lieutenant David Kingsley. Lieutenant Kingsley, a Portland, Oregon native, was killed in action on June 23, 1944, over the oil fields of Floresta, Romania, and was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. So why honor World War II veterans? By passing Senate Bill 449, Oregon will join a growing list of state legislators that have decided that it is both appropriate and timely to honor World War II veterans by dedicating entire highways or portions of highways. Those states include Georgia, California, Virginia, Colorado, New Jersey, Kansas, and Michigan. What does the bill do? Senate Bill 449 establishes an honorary designation that is a regional recognition to honor Oregon's World War II veterans. The bill allows Oregon Department of Transportation to install appropriate informational signage at or near the eight World War II historic sites located along U.S. Highway 97. The signs will inform the traveling public of the historic site and the vital role U.S. 97 played during World War II. What does the bill not do? Because it is an honorary designation, Senate Bill 449 does not change the official name of U.S. I-97 and therefore does not require that any changes be made to maps, mailing, or street addresses. Senate Bill 449 does not interfere with other statewide initiatives to honor Oregon's World War II veterans. Senate Bill 449 does not cost Oregon taxpayers anything. Who pays for the signs and the maintenance? All costs to purchase and install the original signs and any costs associated with the maintenance, replacement of damaged or stolen signs will be paid for entirely by private donations. Two parts of the bill. Section 23A allows Oregon Department of Transportation to accept monies and enter into agreements with veterans groups to create, install, and maintain the markers. Section 23B protects Oregon taxpayers by specifically prohibiting ODOT from using any public funds for the installation and maintenance of the signs. Who supports the bill? We are honored to have broad bipartisan support for the bill, including support of all the legislators whose districts include portions of U.S. Highway 97. In addition, many letters of support of the honorary designation of U.S. Highway 97 as a World War II Veterans Historic Highway have been received, and that is almost 100 letters. That includes all county commissioners, all city councils, all historical societies, and almost all every veterans group along Highway 97. So why now? The median age for World War II veterans is 85 years old for men and 87 years old for women. 75% of the nation's 16 million World War II veterans have already passed away. 400,000 during combat alone, the rest after the World War II. Since starting this project some 19 months ago, over 500,000 U.S. World War II veterans have died. It is estimated that 1,000 U.S. World War II veterans die every day, 15 of them from Oregon. Who speaks for them? In less than 10 years, most of the few remaining veterans of the greatest generation will have vanished from our midst. With so many already gone, someone must speak for them. And that honor has fallen to us, all of us, young and old, veteran, non-veteran, alike, and legislators. For Senate Bill 449 to successfully move through the legislative process, the first step requires a do-pass vote from this committee. We ask you to take that step. Vote to support Senate Bill 449 and join with us to make U.S. Highway 97 in Oregon, the World War II Veterans Historic Highway, a reality. Thank you again for the opportunity to present testimony this morning. We are most happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. What an honor to do this, and I'm so happy that you have brought this forward. My dad and two uncles were World War II vets, and my dad did pass away in October. So, yes, you are right on that we are losing them. And my uncle, Homer Groening, was a fighter pilot flying out of England. And I remember him telling about a mission. He flew over and dropped his bombs, came back to England, and then the next mission that went out was shot down, and he always felt so blessed. But he lost a lot of good comrades over those missions over Germany.
I hope that if you haven't done this, that you will register them in the World War II Memorials Registry of Remembrance. It's easy to do, and if that hasn't been done, I can.
Could you put on the record how you do that?
Yes, I would be happy to do that. But that's a great honor to have to be registered there.
Okay, thank you. All right. Next.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Starl Austin. You've heard what Dick had to say about me. I'm merely here to support him. I have no prepared testimony.
Okay.
I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
It doesn't look...
Well, I like to have a lot of questions over beer someday, but not right now.
May I join you?
Absolutely. We are losing the greatest generation. My father was in the Sunsetters and the Jungleers, fought through New Guinea, Philippines, hand-to-hand combat at times, was the first ground troops in Hiroshima, and suffered radiation effects from that, and ultimately died from those. My uncle served in European theater, and I did a tour in Vietnam. So I come from a long, long family of veterans, and I think it's a great way to honor them. thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's call, I should get my glasses, which I don't have, Mr. Donald?
McDonald,
from the United Veterans of Oregon, and Harley Ray, and Greg Warnock.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mac McDonald. I represent the United Veterans of Oregon, which is every federally chartered veterans organization in the state and some that are not chartered. Seldom do I get a bill where I get as many telephone calls or get cornered by veterans that are opposed to this bill. They're opposed to this bill because the Blue Star Memorial Highway originally was for World War II veterans. After the Vietnamese War, it was changed to honor all veterans. Any change or any name associated with this highway other than the Blue Star Memorial Highway is not liked. By, I can't tell you how mad veterans were after the ceremony we had on the steps yesterday. They cornered me and they said, whatever you do, kill the bill that names this highway anything than a Blue Star Memorial Highway that honors all veterans. They told me that if you pass this bill and rename this highway, you are dishonoring the Korean War veterans and the Vietnamese War veterans and the Gulf War veterans and the current veterans we have today. I just can't express how upset they are with this bill. You'll notice this bill did not come through the United Veterans of Oregon. It bypassed them because what we do, the United Veterans of Oregon, we honor our living, and that's top on our priority. And we honor our dead, but it is not a priority. The first thing is to take care of the living. And this bill will change the name of this highway, according to everybody I've talked to a World War II Memorial Highway. It is not a World War II Memorial Highway. It is a highway that honors all veterans of all wars. And any change whatsoever dishonors the other veterans. If they want to put up signs on the highway, that's fine. If you want to name another highway, go 99 West that goes through Campadea. But please do not change the name or have the name the Vietnam or have it the World War II Memorial Highway. It is a Blue Star Memorial Highway, and that's the way it should be, period. No other designation. And if you want constituents to be upset, you are upset. They are upset with this bill.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm a Vietnam vet, and I think that the World War II veterans are a special class. And I know you're not going to like what I'm going to say, but I don't feel personally that it dishonors me. This is an additional honor to people we're losing rapidly in our society. I like to see more of these designations, and I like to see them as markers for different highways in the state so people remember what's gone on before them. When I sit and talk to high school students and ask them who was in World War II, who were the Axis powers, most of them don't know. They commonly tell me we fought France and Great Britain. That's how badly we understand our history, especially our younger people. So I hope you don't take this as anything personal, but I am a Vietnam vet, and I think still it's just got real value to do this. And I'm not going to sit here and say one thing and do another when the vote comes, so I want you to know where I stand.
Thank you, Senator. I'm a Korean War veteran, and I had 3 tours in Vietnam. And I had no feelings on this at all until I was approached by people from Central Oregon, Eastern Oregon, and they are incensed that someone would change or have that highway designated anything than but a Blue Star Highway. And I've been here for 5 sessions, and I have never had opposition like I've had on this bill in the five sessions I've been here representing United Veterans of Oregon.
Harley Ray.
For the record, my name is Harley Ray. I represent the American Legion. I'm also a Vietnam veteran. I'm also a retired colonel of the United States Army. We took a lot of time trying to make that a Blue Star Highway. It took us a while. We worked on it. It was for all veterans. Like Max says, we do have other highways here that could be very well as a World War II highway. And quite frankly, my service in this country come from the World War II veterans. My parents, during the war, used to drive up to Seattle, and they would always, Dad was always stopped at Fort Lewis, it was like Christmas time, pick up about three guys, throw their duffel bags in the trunk, three guys in the back, and away we'd go, you know. And guess where Harley went? Into the back seat with him. And I've always been a World War II fan of our veterans. That's the guys who gave me the chance to be here today. But I also say this, the Blue Star Highway represents us all. We already have it named there. Let's find us another highway to use that for. Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, Vice Chair Cruz. My name is Greg Warnock. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon War Veterans Association. I provided written testimony this morning and also a copy of the 2007 Cook County Court petition to rename the Highway 97. For your information, it's just a historical document that I think adds to the value of the testimony you heard this morning. We have also been asked by veterans and veterans supporters to support this legislation. After reading the text of the bill, one word stands out predominantly more than the rest, and that is whereas. And I found that a little bit unusual, but there are so many merits to the bill regarding the history and education of Highway 97 as it reflects the service of World War II veterans in particular. And I think that the approach of the original sponsors of this bill to not rename or take away the designation of a Blue Star Highway or to rename the highway in any fashion whatsoever on maps or in cities or on signage, but to simply designate the highway as a historically significant highway that reflects the service of World War II veterans. I think that is very remarkable. And our organization, our board of directors, and many of our members support the legislation. The bill notes many, many reasons to support the project, but making this a historic highway, it's not a memorial designation, it's a historic designation, and we find that to be also significant. We support this and urge a unanimous yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Chair, may I ask a question? It is my understanding, and maybe it's incorrect, that this will remain as a Blue Star Highway. This will just allow additional signage so that we can draw the public attention to not only all veterans, but a special attention to World War II veterans. And anything we could do, I think, to remind the public of what our veterans have done for us, to me, is a plus and a gain. But I want to be sure we're clear on that this remains a Blue Star Highway, and there'll be additional signage for World War II veterans also. Is my concept correct?
And what I'll do now is, are any further questions for this panel? Then.
Comment.
Do you need to make another comment?
Yeah, any other designation other than Blue Star Highway, we are vehemently opposed to. If they take off that designation and just put up the signs, that's fine. If they want to use 99 West, that goes by Camp Adair, which was the largest, I understand, organization in the state, that's fine. But don't designate this highway anything other than the Blue Star Highway. If you do, As far as some veterans are concerned, you're dishonoring all other veterans. That's just the way they feel, and they feel very strongly on this. As I said, after five sessions, I've had more opposition to this changing or putting the name World War II Memorial Highway in this, that's in this bill. They want to do another highway, fine, but not a Blue Star Highway. And Blue Star Highways, incidentally, are throughout the United States. And I come from a military family. I had three brothers that served in World War II. One killed in action. My father was a World War I veteran. I have two children that were veterans. And I served 28 years in the United States Marine Corps and retired as a Marine officer.
Thank you. I'd like to call back Steve West to just address this particular issue, if you would.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bass is absolutely right. The historic highway designation that we are proposing does nothing to impact the Blue Star Highway designation. There are other highways within the country that are both Blue Star highways and have other historic designations. I think in our testimony, I think we provided a long list of highways that I believe in the last count now there's 13 states that have chosen to honor World War II veterans with a portion of a highway or an entire highway or something to that effect. We recognize and honor the Blue Star program. We think that this is a wonderful addition to it. We believe that Highway 97 is unique. Even though Camp Adair is a wonderful facility and there is already historic educational signage on 99W drawing attention to Camp Adair, and we support that. Highway 97 is unique in Oregon history, and that's what we're trying to recognize is this uniqueness, these eight facilities, and in no way is our proposal going to in any way negatively impact the Blue Star program, because we're not asking for an official name change. We're asking for an honorary designation. So again, we'll not change the Blue Star designation, we'll not change anyone's addresses, we'll not change any maps or names on maps. It will recognize the importance of this highway to Oregon history.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Committee?
The General wants to speak to us.
Oh, yes, General Cobb.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. I wasn't going to testify on this bill, but I thought that maybe just for your edification and clarification, a lot of people believe that Highway 26 going out of Portland up to the Oregon coast is called the Sunset Highway because the sun sets in the west. Actually, that's not true. The Sunset Highway is designated because of the 41st Division, which was a World War II Oregon Division, Washington, yeah. Idaho, Montana. And it's got a sign, actually, yeah. If you can find it when it's maintained. A couple of them, one on the east end and one on the west end, as you're coming east. That one's pretty good shape. We actually raised some money, private money, and went to the rest stop, which is halfway between, and did a monument there for the World War II veterans. And basically, it was designed as, like I said, it was designated the 41st Division Sunset Highway. If you look at our patch, now it's 41st Brigade, who are prepared to deploy here this next month and to go off to Iraq. But that was purposely designed that way. I also believe it's a Blue Star Highway. Now, I'm not certain about that, but I know that it's the Sunset Highway, so perhaps if you've got a question, maybe somebody from ODOT or somebody else in the audience knows that it's a Blue Star or not a Blue Star. But it's definitely called, and I know you've all heard it, the Sunset Highway. We've heard it for years. And like I said, most people do not know that it's a 41st Division reason that's there. So it's not uncommon.
Thank you. We do have ODOT in the room if they want to clarify anything that was on record. Do you want to come forward? I know that you were not scheduled to testify.
Amy Joyce, Department of Transportation. Unfortunately, I don't know the answer as to whether 26 is also a Blue Star Highway. I can certainly get that information to the committee today.
Okay. No problem. All right, committee, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 449, and I'd like to open a work session on 449. And I do hear the concerns of Mr. McDonald and Harley Ray, and I take that to heart. In my view, in interpreting this, I felt that it's a historical designation, and it's still going to remain a Blue Star Highway. Having been in the 60s, I would love to see a designation for the Vietnam vets, Korean War, definitely Afghanistan and Iraq, and I bet you now that we are doing these types of things that we are going to start memorializing those veterans who served in those different wars, and I'm hoping that that will happen. Comments from the committee?
Well, I guess my comments are the same as yours. I'd like to see this kind of designation spread across the state and as a reminder to people what these people have done for us, what these veterans have done for us. I'm really sorry that there's disagreement here. I'm certainly not trying to be in any way less than honorable to every veteran, not just those in World War II. I guess I will say this with a little bit of humor. Well, we're Americans. We can't agree on anything, you know. And, you know, I get together with my son-in-law who's a Marine, and we go around and around about, you know, a bunch of idiots the Marines are, and I'm an Army guy, and he thinks I'm an idiot for the same reason. You know,
take care of you.
We've had to bail the Marines out so many times, it's just unbelievable. It's just a bad situation. And I also like to make a comment, there are way too many ex-officers and officers in this room. I'm an NCO, E5, so, you know, I'm not sure I trust anything you guys have said. Okay? I never trusted an officer as far as I can pick him up and throw him, but... I had to do what he told me. So, having said all that, I'm still going to vote for this, and I hope you do not take that in any way in the wrong vein.
You'll
have to come up.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've made my point. I'll stop there.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I echo the comments of the panel here. To me, the name is very reflective of what happened in that corridor, historic. There were very significant locations and events that happened, and that name, I believe, reflects that. And surely the heart of Oregon is big enough for all of those that served. And so, Madam Chair, I'm supporting the bill.
Yeah. Yeah, Madam Chair, I would never do anything to dishonor any veteran, period. I'm almost thinking that there may be a misconception out there as to what this actually does. And I agree with Senator Morris, the historical significance, I mean, that slideshow was just amazing. You know, that's the sort of stuff that Oregonians need to know. And we don't. We flat out don't know. I'm a student of history. I didn't know all those connections.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this is not. There's nothing negative in this vote. Nothing at all. This is not in any way lessening our honor of any veteran. And we need to make sure that that's clear. And with that, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 449 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 449 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Morset.
Excused.
Senator Morris.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chairman Anderson.
Aye. Motion carries, and we've already designated Senator Whitsitt and Senator Ferrioli as carriers of the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 449, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 606. Mr. Shook, would you clarify what
sure.
this bill does?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 606 6 directs the Oregon Military Department and the Department of Veterans Affairs to create information campaigns on certain mental and physical disorders affecting veterans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let's call Jim Willis and General Mike Caldwell to the forefront first. And while they're getting ready, I would like to state that the Veterans Department has had an interim committee, and they had put forth several bills. And when I had staff looking through it, we found that this bill that is put forward to you today was definitely in the interim report, but did not make the cut list for the priority bills that they had. But I felt so strongly regarding the mental and physical health of our veterans and that we are not doing enough to take care of them that I, along with Senator Schrader and Senator Boquist, has brought this forward. And yes, it would probably have a fiscal, and that probably was another reason why you didn't bring the bill forward, but we need to start really caring for our veterans, and we have been woefully, I think, dishonorable in a way in not being able to provide for them like we should. With that, Mr. Willis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 606, which directs the Department of Veterans Affairs, in conjunction with the Oregon Military Department, to develop and implement public awareness campaigns on military sexual trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, and suicide. As you are aware, the Governor's Task Force on Veterans Services identified the need for awareness on all of these issues. And Senate Bill 606 is consistent with the task force recommendations to educate the public, veterans, and state agencies about veteran suicide, MST, PTSD, and TBI. Before the legislature convened, ODVA took the initiative on the suicide awareness front by producing radio and television advertising that ran for 6 weeks between December and January. I believe so strongly in helping our struggling veterans that I made the decision that we would spend $45,000 on this statewide campaign. Our vendors also believed in our campaign and offered free television and radio spots in conjunction with the ones we purchased. If you will allow, Madam Chair, I would like to show you our television ad at this time.
Well, powerful, powerful scenes.
Why don't you continue on? We'll go back to these.
Madam Chair, I'm going to continue until we solve the volume problem with your permission.
Yes.
All right. As you can imagine, there's a lot of work being done by the military, ODVA, and others regarding educating veterans and their families about these subjects. I know that every veteran that sees a veteran service officer or is assessed by the military department is asked about all of these issues. But coordinating our efforts is important, and I believe Senate Bill 606 will help direct ODVA, the military department, and the reintegration team to work that much more closely together on these important issues. I especially want to thank the Chair for including military sexual trauma, which is the least known of the issues. It is vital that we do more to make our veterans aware of the issues and, more importantly, make them more comfortable in coming forward for help. I promise you, Madam Chair and committee members, that regardless of whether this bill passes or not, ODVA will continue to work on educating the public, veterans, and others regarding these issues affecting Oregon veterans. I'd like to thank you for your consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Question? General?
I think we'll let Tom play it. I think we figured it out. Mute button down at the bottom.
We'll find out.
Give it a try, Tom.
Okay, it's loading.
Go down there again. Go down the bottom. Don't do the full screen first. Get it started first, and then.
Okay, let's do this.
You still have that.
This.
Yeah, right there.
There we go.
There you go. Still not working?
No, still not working.
Why don't we go ahead with the testimony?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. We're here in support of Senate Bill 606. And clearly, that as Mr. Willis has explained, testified to, I think that we've had a lot of the things that we have learned through this process with respect to the 7 years now that we've been deploying soldiers and airmen to combat zones, frankly, we just didn't understand before we started seeing the results. The Department of Defense is just initiated a major operation over suicide prevention to the point where the Chief Staff of the Army directed that all of the active duty units stand down and start talking about this issue, because it's certainly something that has affected not only the active component but also the Guard and Reserve. We have just initiated, General Reese just put out an all hands on deck letter to tell commanders that there's a program now that the Army has provided, that we're working with every command to stop everybody from what they're doing and make them understand that there are resources out there that they can reach. The other plug I would put in is that the Oregon Partnership, we have we're in, and Judy Cushing's in the room. We have worked hand in glove with them. They've been to all of our reintegration meetings. They're working with our staff right now to, and we use their resource a lot. A lot of our soldiers use it. It's an Oregon-based organization. They feel comfortable with it. The Army and the Department of Defense has a 1-800 number that I think our folks are more comfortable with, actually knowing that when they pick up the phone and they do need have a need, that they call a number that they have an Oregonian on the other end of a local person. In Oregon, we're a little bit unique in some respects, because we're one of few states in the Union that has a fairly significant military presence. The military presence in Oregon is the Guard and Reserve primarily. We'd like to call ourselves Fort Oregon as opposed to Fort Lewis or Fort Hood or someplace like that, because we are basically the only game in town. One of the most interesting experiences that I've witnessed over the last 7 years is not only have we seen a lot of trauma, we've seen a lot of the TBI issues, we've seen a lot of stress issues that have arisen that we frankly did not anticipate. We were busy getting people ready to go off to war. We didn't really think very thoroughly at the outset in 2002 and 2003 about what the impacts were going to be and what we do when they came back. We recognize that. We were early in the game of recognizing that we got a problem here. We were facing this. We need to deal with it. We didn't know how to deal with it. So we formed a reintegration team. I like to say that we're still in the process of building our bike while we ride it, because there's still a lot we don't know. We've had great participation from state agencies, from veterans groups, from all walks of life and all corners of the state have stepped up to help us deal with some of these issues. We have a summit every 6 months here in Salem at the Anderson Readiness Center. You're all invited to attend. The next one's on the 19th, I believe, 19th of this month. And we invite people in to discuss these issues and talk about what, and basically the agenda is wide open. We've learned how to deal with the Veterans Administration, which we didn't really understand before. They've been very helpful. And I think things are getting better in general. That's
a broad statement. It's certainly not, data can define it different ways, but I would tell you that I think the support that we've gotten from all these different groups has been tremendous. This is another example, I think, of an opportunity in this bill to continue that good work, continue putting that out so the general public understands it as well, not just the people that have a stakeholder or an interest in the subject. So we fully support this. We think it's a good idea. I think when we look back on the Veterans Task Force, it wasn't that it was recognized it wasn't important. I think it was just exactly what you said. There's a certain amount of money that's going to have to be allocated for this type of operation. Not a lot, but it's going to have some meager dollars. And I think that's money well spent. So I'll conclude with that and answer any questions you might have.
I think we'll... Do you have another question, Mr. Bullock?
I just have, Madam Chair, if I may, I just have one comment on one segment of this bill, which I think it's important for the committee to know. And so I'll just give you a couple of real quick figures as to why we take this issue of veteran suicide so seriously. All of these other issues that we're going to address here are addressed with living people. Of course, suicide, that's the end of life. And so to put it in context, 6,000 American veterans a year are taking their own lives in America. That's 16 people every single day. In Oregon, according to the Oregon Violent Death Reporting System, from the years 2000 to 2006, in that time frame, 1,066 Oregon veterans took their own lives in our state. That got my attention. And I'm sure it's gotten the attention of anybody who's heard the numbers. That's why we decided to do the awareness program. That's why I'm so proud of our National Guard reintegration team and their efforts. And our biggest promotion was the 1-800-237-TALK or 1-800-237-8255 national hotline. Here's a figure for you that is also shocking, at least to me. On a per capita basis, we rank 37th in the nation in the number of veterans we have in our population. Using that same format, we rank 13th in the nation in the number of people calling that hotline. Mm. That tells me that we have people that, thank goodness, are getting the word through these campaigns that we're operating and the ones that the Guard is operating. But it also tells me we have much more work to do. So that's another reason why we welcome the support of Senate Bill 606, and as I said before, whether it passes or not, and whether additional funds are allocated, we're going to continue this effort. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. We have two more people to testify on this. Judy Cushing is going to talk about the hotlines that we already have in existence, and then Paul Evans, I asked him if he could give a personal testimonial on what he has gone through. So he will be, we won't be moving this bill, work sessioning it, because we don't have a fiscal, and then we'll have that discussion on whether we want to move it down to Ways and Means or not.
Good morning. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Judy Cushing, and I'm president of the Oregon Partnership. We are a statewide nonprofit organization here in Oregon providing alcohol and drug prevention, education, treatment, and crisis services. You've heard a lot about the very important members of our military, the warriors that serve our state and our nation, and you're also hearing a bit, you heard a bit just now about how we feel we aren't serving them. They serve us. We aren't serving them so well. Oregon, as General Caldwell mentioned previously, Oregon Partnership operates the state crisis alcohol and drug lines and call center. We have a highly trained staff and 75 volunteers that go through 58 hours of training to serve on that line, and those aren't your typical volunteers. Some are retired military, some are airline pilots, lawyers, accountants, et cetera. These are people who want to give back. That line is staffed 24 hours a day. We responded to 3,011 calls in January, and we got the numbers yesterday, 2,097 calls in February. There are a couple fewer days in February. The call volume, the calls on the line have increased 71% since January of 2008. That is a huge, huge increase. When you heard the suicide line number presented to you by Mr. Willis, we are the Lifeline Center in Oregon. In other words, when people call that line, if they do not press 1 to indicate they're a veteran, it comes directly to us. We are not compensated for that, but we are the suicide line in Oregon and would not turn away suicide calls and became a part of the National Lifeline Network. It is becoming an increasing challenge for us because the problems that these young men and women face are so serious. They're the stealth issues that create life-challenging and life-changing issues in not only the soldier's life, but the lives of their families. You hear about it every day, but I don't think it's really hitting home with our public. We can't stress enough the needs of these veterans and their families, how quietly they are suffering, and how serious the issue is. The increase in calls over the last year have not just been the numbers in the calls, but the severity of the calls, the seriousness of the calls. It's time, really, for us to initiate. We support Senate Bill 606 wholeheartedly because we feel we must educate not only the public, but Oregon soldiers that there is a place for them to call. There is a place for them to get safe, confidential counseling and help. That, in fact, there are people who care about them. There are people who care about their families. We welcome the opportunity to collaborate with Oregon National Guard, as we have been now for well over a year, and with the Veterans Administration. We have extensive experience. Running suicide lines is not something you just pick up and do. We operate and use protocols around suicide intervention that are international protocols and are the way to do business around trying to prevent people from suicides. Saturday evening, we facilitated 4 rescues. This coming weekend, as a result of a small grant from a community foundation here in Oregon, we are installing new software on the crisis lines that will allow us to track specifically populations who are calling us. Right now, we can tell you how many calls, we can tell you the person's problem, we can tell you the county they're calling from, but we want to be able to tell you more about those calls from our military servicemen and their families, and we're going to be able to do that as a result of this software. In a few months, several thousand soldiers are going to be deployed from our state. The National Guard is working diligently with their reintegration teams and their pre-deployment teams to prepare these soldiers and their families. We are a part of that, but educating the public and educating them about what is available to them in a confidential, safe place to go is incredibly important, and we support this bill. We wish that your colleagues in the legislature could see, as you do, the seriousness of suicide and the seriousness of the suicide issue among our returning soldiers and veterans, and address it with some resources that will not only produce a public education campaign, but support the crisis services in this state.
Was the phone number
yes.
the same as yours?
We are that Lifeline number. If they do not press 1, if they press 1, they go through the veteran services. But the veterans leaders have come to us and said there are people who don't want to self-reveal at that time and need a place to go that they can just talk to someone. We can triage them then to the veterans services and those that they qualify for. And we understand that there are a lot of young military people who are worried about jeopardizing their military career by revealing they have a mental health problem, a suicide problem, or an alcohol and drug problem. And so we're that kind of safety net stopgap in between that will help get them the help where they need to get them. So we're a partner with all of the agencies.
Do you get general fund?
We get only $50,000 a year presently from the general fund, and we don't think anything is in the general fund for the next time around. We do not know. Right now, the crisis lines are almost fully supported by federal block grant dollars, and that pays for only one-third of the cost of the lines. And believe me, the costs are minimal compared to a for-profit call center because of the 75 volunteers. We have 6 paid staff. Some of those are part-time staff. We have to raise those funds, and this year that's going to be impossible. So the crisis lines are really in jeopardy.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just put my ways and means hat on for a second if I can. And Judy, does that block grant have anything to do with match money from us, or is it a straight block grant?
It's a straight block grant.
Okay. And
Yes, I'm sorry, Senator Bates. It is the federal block grant out of SAMHSA. I do not know that it requires a match like the treatment bed area of the block grant does, so I can't say for certain, but it's my understanding that it probably does, because it does come out of SAMHSA.
I'm afraid it probably does, Madam Chair. Can I follow up?
Mm-hmm.
This, I assume, is part of the DHS budget?
Yes, it is.
Could you talk to me afterwards about this,
please? Yes, I could.
I chair that budget, and I want to hear more about this particular program.
Okay.
We don't want your lines to go away.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Paul.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Evans, policy advisor to Governor Kulongoski on military veterans and emergency management issues. And before I go to my prepared comments, I'm not even going to say testimony because they're scrambled all over these notes. The thing that I want to emphasize about Judy's program is that the button one option, whether a vet self-select or not at that point, fine, everybody's getting care. The reason that her program is essential is that with military families that aren't entitled to specific kind of care because they're the family as opposed to the veteran, that is going to become even more important as we have this major deployment. So I'm not here asking for money, but money would be helpful in that particular effort, because I'm most concerned about the families, especially the second deployment families, that psychologically Iraq's going to change a whole lot, and there's going to be a lot of questions and a lot of feelings that haven't really been experienced quite yet. So that program is essential. So I'll get off that soapbox and just tell you thank you for all that you do for the families. As I sit here today, trying to put my thoughts into some kind of package, I was a little bit concerned when Senator Bates mentioned that he doesn't trust officers, much less the ones he can throw. So I'm in a little bit of trouble in that particular area, having been commissioned in 1993 and served ever since.
And look how big you are.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. I'm kind of hosed there. There's no way that you're going to be addressing me, I guess. What I really want to do is I want to kind of cover a couple of different topics that are related to the mental health, the access to information about military sexual trauma, the access to kind of the whole family concept, and ultimately why it matters. And as I try to put these thoughts together, there are 3 or 4 general pieces. One, the first I want to start with is credibility, and I'll get back to that before I get too far down the road. The second is why it matters. The third is why it matters at this particular time, and I'm going to talk briefly about some things that President Lincoln said at an interesting time in history, and why taking care of veterans is even more important at this point, despite the budgetary challenges. And then I'd like to close and basically emphasize that the only way we're going to get through these next 3 or 4 years as a state, because of the way that Oregon is if we get creative, because the money and the economy are going to be a challenge for everybody. So going back to credibility, I handed out something I really don't do that often. Handed out my resume, and the reason I did that to the committee members is sometimes you hear me talking about the military, you hear me talking about veterans issues, and I think it's important to kind of know that while I am just an average guy, I have been around the block enough times to say what I say, and I try not to overpromise on those things. It's been said earlier that every generation of soldiers is standing on the shoulders of those that went before, and though I don't know that former Governor McCall meant it in this context when he said that heroes are not giant statues framed against the red sky. They're people that say, this is my community, and it's my job to make it better. I happen to believe that the World War II generation, Korean generation, and Vietnam generation soldiers are, in fact, those heroes, whatever they did. And the Cold War soldiers fought a war just as important as any shooting war that kept the peace for 40 years. So one of the major emphases of this entire project from day one has been to try to make sure that people understand that veterans don't choose the wars that they get to fight. They make one simple choice, whether you were drafted or not, whether you were drafted. Are you going to stand up and support the Constitution and try to make this country stronger than it was, and are you willing to pay the price? If you say yes to that, that's what it really means to be a veteran. And that's one of the things that we're focusing on. In my own case, because it was asked to kind of tell my story and why these issues are important to me, as you can tell from the earlier dialogue, every veteran is passionate about their views, though we sometimes differ. It was important to me that we brought people around the table and came up with a formula that we could all agree on. And the 39 recommendations in the task force, everybody agrees that those are the big pieces on the table. We have different differences of opinions about different bills outside that, but those 39 recommendations are important, and the reason that we were all able to come to an agreement is because we understand the long-term risk of not coming to an agreement. And again, in my case, I came to, I was commissioned in 1993. I spent 4.5 years in the drug wars, which no one likes to talk about, down in Central and South America, which were really counterinsurgency by a different name. I actually was in Colombia in 1996 when Cobar Towers went down. I lost some of my wing in that incident. And I was there to witness the transformation of the drug cartel from a predominantly Marxist atheist viewpoint to an Islamic militant viewpoint, which was an interesting process because it changed the tactics, and things that would previously have been unthought of in a Catholic context became much more real and much very harder to combat. So spent 4.5 years roughly in the active duty, came back, joined the Guard. During the first stint on the active side, I participated in the deny flight operations over the Adriatic that prosecuted targets trying to make peace in Bosnia. Because of that, when I got out and thought I was done, a buddy called and said the 116th Air Control Squadron in Oregon needed a guy who was a little cranky, which I had gotten by that time. And I went in 1998 to Italy to support the ongoing Kosovo buildup. And we actually prepared for what became, in 1999, the Kosovo air war. Had a busted knee at that point, was not able to go, tried to volunteer, was too slow to get there. So in 2001 was the next time I had an opportunity to volunteer for a mission. The weird thing about Guard and Reservists is that it isn't that we like being away from our family, it isn't that we like sometimes even the tasks that we have to do, but if you have skill sets and you have experience, it's incumbent upon you to perform the mission and to teach those that don't know how to do some of the jobs through mentoring. And I view that good officers in the Guard, whether it's during a hot war or cold war, should be deployed about every 3 years. So you don't lose that skill set and you don't lose the connection between how the world still functions and how to lead men and women in situations that you're going to ask them to do some terrible things. So, as many can attest in my life, as you look at the resume, timing has never been really one of my strong points. I volunteered and went June 25th, 2001 to sunny Kuwait for my second trip to Kuwait. I got back September 5th, 2001. For those of you that recall September 01, it was somewhat of an interesting and busy time. I was actually sitting at my Guard unit on September 11th writing the last medal for one of my kids when a sergeant came up and said he needs to go look at the TV. Somebody has flown a plane into the buildings. At first, we all thought some idiot had driven a Piper Cub into a building, and then it became fairly obvious pretty quickly that second and third attacks, that was probably not a Piper Cub, and that had been pre-planned. So I got to relive a moment that my history professor had once told me about. He had been in Astoria Pearl Harbor Day when the Coast Guard painted their ships gray, and he remembered how the guys prepared the ships because they were at war. And at the 116th Air Control Squadron, which is the only organic tactical radar west of Utah, we were controlling F-15s within an hour and my mission had been decelerated to us, though people will swear differently these days. We had engagement authority down at our level. So I was controlling F-15s over the Pacific Northwest with orders to shoot and kill anything that wouldn't abide. So September 11th, to me, that was the day. Now, for folks that were serving at that time, I don't want to speak for all of them, but I think I can speak for at least my generation of them. September 11th was and has remained very important. And when people ask, well, you know, Iraq, how could you justify going to Iraq and this, that, and other thing, it's irrelevant. What happened to us on September 11th was my generation of soldiers failed. And every generation before us, at least since World War II, had been able to keep the peace and make these deals with yourself, especially in the 90s, that you do these horrible things that you're not supposed to do in normal life, because by being aggressive and assertive overseas, home is kept safe. And September 11th, that theory came up a little short. So a lot of us of that generation took it very personal. Not as personal, clearly, as those that had family members involved, and that was a tragedy. But when they came at us and they hit the Pentagon, that was a specific moment for young officers of my generation. And we, whether we said it aloud or over beer or at other times, we said, never again on our watch is that going to happen. So at that point, the President of the United States put a couple of Air Guard units on something called involuntary status. I spent 24 months of involuntary service. That's kind of like going to prison, but with a little better pay and better food. And we were sent to the air route traffic control centers, because in the rapid deceleration of the 50s to the 60s of not thinking we really had to worry about internal threats, we'd done away with all the radar and all the communications equipment inside the CONUS, so we couldn't track down potential threats inside the country. So we were operating combat air patrols across the United States, and they sent people like myself to Albuquerque and Utah and places like that with orders to shoot and kill anything that had become a weapon. The idea of using our own airliners against us is something we had trained for many years, but no one had ever thought it would actually happen. So when it did, we were sent to the air traffic control centers with our little classified books to be able to authenticate actions, and my job was, quite frankly, literally to be prepared to shoot down an airliner full of folks going to Disneyland, because it had been used, it had been turned into a weapon. That does something to your mindset when you get ready to do those things. And for about a year and a half, I kept trying to get over to Afghanistan, and finally in 2003, when we got the word that war was coming to Iraq, I was given a phone call from the commander of, at the time, the 728th Air Control Squadron, and I was literally sold for a case of beer. A general that I worked for in Florida at the time at NORAD had to sign a piece of paper for me to go, because I was on, and this gets really weird, but I was on domestic orders as opposed to overseas orders. And anyway, for a case of beer, he signed the piece of paper, and I was illegally sent over to the 728th, and I eventually went over to Kuwait and Iraq on homeland security orders, which was nonetheless something we had to reconcile a little bit later. But I was involved.
Paul, yes. We need, okay, in about a couple minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I was involved in the Baghdad 03 mission. It was poorly planned, poorly executed. We didn't have the material we needed. And for the first time in my career, I had lost one of my guys. And in Central and South America, we got pretty good at getting people in and out of hostile situations and thought we were pretty smart. The point I'm trying to say is that 2003 was the first time that I had failed like that. So I spent a couple years trying to make it up. I went back to Balad in 05 trying to make it up. Went back in Afghanistan in 06 trying to make it up. And for my generation of soldiers and airmen, going doesn't fix the problem. And it basically allows you an opportunity to put things on hold one more time and one more time and one more time. It cost me a marriage, it cost me a job, it cost me a couple of political opportunities and jobs. It cost me a little bit of my sanity. And finally in 2008, I asked for help and am trying to day by day get through it. The point I'm trying to make is it is a terribly complicated process, the way we're fighting the war right now. It isn't a situation where the entire nation went to war. The rest of the country went shopping. We went to war. It isn't a situation where the mission is clear. How do you fight terrorism? Well, you don't. You pick a few battles. We're about to lose in Iraq. And I have to look the family in the eye of some folks that didn't get to come back about a war that, for whatever reason, this country said we needed to go fight, so we went. That's the bottom line. So at this point, I know that your job is very hard. You've got an economy that's in the shambles, and you've got to make choices that affect real people at all kinds of levels, especially through the Ways and Means process. My only counter to that is, during the Civil War, at the hardest moment in American history to that time, Lincoln went to Gettysburg. And you've all read the address. I'm not going to bore you with that. But he said something that was pretty important. He said that no words could matter, that the actions of the folks that had fallen mattered. And he also, I think, issued a challenge whether a government can survive based on people willing to make it survive. And whether you agreed with the war, don't agree with the war, that's not my point. What my point is that this generation of soldiers in the all-volunteer force, in a time where we didn't make the military bigger, in a time where women are serving in ways that have never been asked of them before, where we are asking and putting immense pressure on the same folks to go over and over and over again, we have a choice. And the choice isn't about money. The choice is what our values are. Are we going to be the generation that said, well, we let the 2% of the folks struggle? Or are we going to be the folks that actually stand up and said, the military and their families and all the folks that are associated with it are an investment? My grandpa, who had an eighth grade education, used to say that somebody somewhere pays the price. Right now, for the last 8 years, largely because of the last administration, we've been very content to let the very few pay the price. And ultimately, every one of us is going to have to look ourselves in the mirror 30 or 40 years from now asking if we did everything we could to live up to the obligations that we had been handed. So the bills that we're putting before you, the ideas, the argument, it all boils down to this. What kind of country do we want to have? What kind of value system do we have? Do we recognize that those that have served deserve more, I think, than you said, more than just a plaque on a road? We have an opportunity here. This generation of warriors has about 24 to 36 months of being able to help make sure that there's not a 30 or 40 year problem. It really is up to us. We have an impact here. And at the same time, because of neglect, we have an opportunity to make sure that the Vietnam era generation of warriors are given the respect and the support that they need. We didn't get here overnight. And this problem is important. I'm not telling you it's more important than school days or more important than any other things you have to do. But I do use that historical analogy. During the middle of crisis, Lincoln went to the battlefield to say, we have to do something special about this. So anyway, that's my story. And I
really appreciate that, Paul, because I think it makes a difference if we, you know, that we couldn't find veterans to tell us who have used the system. And your perspective, I think, means a whole lot to us in helping us make our decision.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
And we have to hurry on. So thank you very much, both of you. And I'll close the public hearing on 606. And we need to open a Senate Bill 520 to get the hepatitis C. This is something that comes very, very every year. We need to hear where they're coming from. And I know we also have to pass out HJR 10. But we have testimony, but I was so afraid that if you don't mind, colleagues, hopefully we can go right until a little after 10, if that's possible. So come on forward. Let's see. Ann Thomas, let's see, Lauren, is this all three of you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
13.
Please proceed.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Ann Thomas, a public health physician with the Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology in the Oregon Department of Human Services. I'm here to provide information on Senate Bill 520, which seeks to implement an Oregon State Hepatitis C Strategic Plan. Senate Bill 520 would require DHS to conduct a health education campaign and community outreach to raise public awareness of hepatitis C, educate staff at local health departments, mental health facilities, and medical providers about hepatitis C, and establish a pilot program for voluntary hepatitis C testing. Hepatitis C is an important public health problem. It's the most common viral blood-borne infection in the United States. It's become the most common cause of chronic liver disease in the U.S., and chronic liver disease is now the 12th leading cause of death nationally. Based on data from a CDC study of hepatitis C in the U.S. population, we estimate that nearly 48,000 Oregonians carry the hepatitis C virus, which is 10 times the number of Oregonians living with HIV/AIDS. Many of these individuals have no symptoms and do not know they are infected. Nearly 10,000 Oregonians will develop cirrhosis due to hepatitis C, and 1 to 2,000 will die from hepatitis C. Oregon Health and Science University performs liver transplantation on 20 to 30 individuals with hepatitis C annually. Like HIV, hepatitis C can be spread by injection drug use. It is roughly 10 times more transmissible by needle stick than is HIV. It is much less likely to be transmitted sexually than HIV. We recommend that if a hepatitis C testing program were implemented statewide, priority would be given to testing persons who admit to injection drug use. Greater public awareness of the problem of hepatitis C and the availability of hepatitis C testing and counseling could prevent or change behavior that place persons at risk for hepatitis C infection and could reduce disease transmission. Additionally, identifying patients with hepatitis C early in the course of their disease and counseling them on ways to prevent further damage to their livers could reduce the number of patients who would later require costly treatment. In summary, development of an Oregon State Hepatitis C strategic plan would address an important public health problem, and we at DHS support the policy of providing free screening to every Oregonian at risk of hepatitis C. There are costs related to implementing the requirements of this bill that are not included in the governor's recommended budget. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Let's hear.
Senator Mona Sanderson, Chair Mona Sanderson, thank you very much for having us testify today. I'm Lauren Sant with the Caring Ambassadors Program. And actually, since I have testified so many times before you in the past, and you know exactly how I feel about this, I'm going to stick with my written testimony. You have that in front of you. There are some graphs and charts in there that I'd like you to take a look at the cost. But I'm going to turn my time over to Steve Graham. He's someone you haven't heard from before. And let Steve talk to you. I've known Steve since I got into this in 1999, and he's been doing it longer than I have. So I thought it would be someone new and different for you to hear from today. So thank you very much for having this hearing. I appreciate it. And you know how I feel about Senate Bill 520.
And, Lauren, you have been such an advocate for this since I came into the building in 2001. And so I thank you for your persistence in keeping this in the forefront on our minds.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your time. And I'm Steve Graham, for the record. I'm the president and co-founder of an outfit called the Hepatitis Education Project, which is a nonprofit based in Seattle, which does patient education, advocacy, and support primarily for hepatitis C patients, but also for hepatitis B. I've been a hepatitis educator, and I do a lot of classes for hepatitis. I'm on the board of the National Viral Hepatitis Roundtable. I've been a patient advocate for about 15 years, and I'm also doing a lot of work in Washington State inside the prisons doing inmate education for prisoners. I think most of you know that inmates in prison are roughly 1 out of 3 have hepatitis C. It's a very high rate and a very low rate of diagnosis and a very low rate of knowledge. And so we were fortunate enough to get a contract to do inmate education within the prisons in Washington State. We've been doing it for about 4 or 5 years. And we were very much inspired in that work and also supported in it by Oregon's own Phyllis Beck, who I know you know and are familiar with. She was a fabulous resource for us and a personal friend, and we're very saddened by her loss. She inspired us a lot to go to work in the prison area, and we have done a lot of work there since then, and we've been involved 4 or 5 years. We also inherited her HCBN Prison website and are now, as the Hepatitis Education Project is becoming the formal people who manage that website and do the work for it. We're trying to carry on the work that she's done without, quite measuring up, I fear. She's a wonderful woman, and we really miss her a lot. I'm a hepatitis C patient myself. I've had the disease for over 40 years. I contracted it during Army service, actually, and during the Vietnam War, about 1966 or 67. And I was undiagnosed pretty much until about 1992. 1991, when I finally realized that I had this illness. At that time, there was essentially very little or almost nothing available for patients. And over time, over the next year or two, I began to make contact with a lot of other patients, and I began to put together, with the help from some of our medical folks, an organization to put together a support group and to begin to educate people and try to gather information about this. And that led to the formation of the Hepatitis Education Project in 1993. We were originally just a support group in Seattle, but over time that it built out into a large scale, many support groups around the state. We began publishing a newsletter. We eventually opened an office, got a little bit of staff, not much, but some. And have been very anxious and hardworking in the area of patient advocacy and support in the Seattle area and in the region for now 15 years, or going on 16. Now, in testifying, what I'm doing here today is talking a little bit about the situation in Washington State, because that's what I know the best. And what I've done in lieu of written testimony is to hand out a surveillance document, and you may see that. Has been developed in Washington State recently, and I believe, if I understand correctly, Oregon is now in a similar situation where Washington was about 2 years ago before they began to appropriate a little bit of money to do some of the work in the strategic plan for Hep C. We had a plan for Hep C, but because of budgetary constraints, the legislation actually read that we could not spend money on it, any public money on it, for at least 4 years after the plan was actually created. And so that term has expired, and now there's a certain amount of money being allocated for this. And so information, although the disease was under surveillance or was reportable beginning in 2000, very little was done with the information. It had just accumulated in the health department, and there wasn't staff or resources available to do much with it. And so now they're beginning to really put that information out. And as you see it in front of you, I want to try to look at that as maybe a model for what you might see here. And I don't know if you're getting these kinds of reports, but I don't think they're out here yet. And there's some interesting material in there that's, I think, quite analogous to what you might see. I can't go over all of it. It's a 25-page document. But I wanted to call your attention particularly to page 21. There's a graph there of deaths due to hepatitis C, hepatitis C-related deaths in Washington State. And I think you can see that's a fairly dramatic graph, and it's definitely telling a story. And I think that story is going to be quite analogous to what you're going to find here, if in fact those numbers are run up. And they may be. I'm just of the opinion that I've heard that isn't quite happening yet. Finally, I would talk about on page 17. There's a breakdown by county, which I find really very interesting and is helpful in sort of healthcare planning in the Washington State environment. So what you'll see, if you look at page 17, you've got the counties rank ordered by the percentage of people who are diagnosed with hepatitis C. And what you see in there is that King County, the major urban county, the one that's the center of Seattle and is really the big urban section, is ranked number 9 there. It's not number 1. The highest ranked counties are actually very, very often rural counties and fairly remote from the big urban centers. This creates a lot of issues for us, and the healthcare in these areas is not nearly as strong as it is in the urban centers, and so there's a real problem. This disease is spread quite evenly through the population. It's more evenly distributed than comparable illnesses that you might see. And so the delivery of healthcare here is kind of problematic because the people who are out in these areas have both a stigma issue and a health care issue and a delivery issue. So we know that in Eastern Washington there are long waits for appointments with gastrointestinal doctors, that we don't have people to deliver the results. And so this is a very tough thing to treat. And for that reason, we've become really involved in and trying to promote a telemedicine approach within Washington State to try and deliver. The problem is really, especially if we move now to what people are talking about as universal health care, and we begin to say, okay, everyone is going to get treated for this, how are we going to deliver it? We don't have the people, and we don't have in the places. Washington State has really excellent hepatitis C resources within the University of Washington Medical Center, within the Harborview, within the central cities, some of the best people in the world, transplant centers, terrific stuff. But in the areas where a lot of the concentrations are, that support really tails off. And you may very well find that is true here as well. And I don't know if it is, but I think that may very well turn out to be what's...
Ms. Thomas, do you know the distribution of Hep C in the state of Oregon?
What we have is that we've made hepatitis C reportable by labs, but the numbers are so high, we get 6,000 to 7,000 reports a year. We can't ask the counties to investigate every case, so we don't get very much information about them. But roughly, it's interesting. I suspect that it is very high in rural areas. One thing I can tell you is that we get, of the 6,000 to 7,000 reports, about a third of them are in Multnomah County, but that's still a lot in the rest of the state. And we have tried to do some pilot programs where we've given counties the money just to be able to offer the test for free, and they're not able to implement that program very well because they don't have the staff to do all the counseling and testing. But anecdotally, you talk to those people, and it's like, well, you know, we might get one positive HIV test a year, but we're seeing numbers in settings where they may be able to do 100 Hep C tests a year, they get 30 or 40 positives. That's several people a month who need a lot of hand-holding and a lot of counseling and need to get referred to services that often, and that's very difficult. People often don't want to take up the issue of testing them when, gosh, we don't have much out here we can do for them. I would not be surprised. I think the other thing that we hear from CDC is, well, you need to integrate with your HIV programs, but kind of the epidemiology of HIV in Oregon is it is largely a disease of men who have sex with men, and so most of the money is in our large urban counties, and there's very, very little money out in our rural counties. So the places that do have the highest need aren't getting the HIV funding, and so the infrastructure isn't as good out there to develop these programs.
And that's exactly the problem in Washington State as well. I mean, we want to do, and we are developing ways to try and cooperate and work well together with the HIV folks, because they have a set of services and a set of products and a set of contacts that are really helpful in getting at this. But because of the way the thing is distributed, there are a lot of areas where there just isn't any HIV service, or is almost none. And so you really need to build service in these areas. You can't just rely on existing service postures in these areas. It's very tough to operate in some of these places. And so we're hoping the telemedicine has been developed in New Mexico in a very successful way by a doctor down there who's done great work. And we have a clone of that beginning to develop in Washington State, and we're using it in several places, and it's a thing to think about. There also is, I should mention, with the small amount of money that's been allocated in 2007-2009, there's also been a testing and screening program similar to what you're talking about here. The public health clinics are given free test kits and are able to deliver testing, and I know over 1,000 tests have been done since June. That's when we're doing them also. We get test kits in a hepatitis education project, and we offer free testing, and we go out and do testing in the field, in homeless shelters. We do youth advocate areas, and we've done a lot of work there. There's also vaccination funds that are available now, and so hepatitis B and hepatitis A vaccines are now being given away in a lot of at-risk individuals where people really need the service. So progress is being made. There's stuff moving forward with the funding that's happening, and I'm hoping very much that this bill will move forward in Oregon as well. Obviously, I support it. You should not be surprised.
Okay. Well, in looking at just preliminary, we don't have a fiscal, but, you know, I'm just throwing numbers out. $100,000 for media, $30,000 for talks, $200,000 to the counties, $15 per blood draw. So we're talking, you know, money again, but it doesn't mean that this
I'll just have to talk to the committee to see if we're going to send this to Ways and Means.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm hearing that we should.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Madam Chair, I know I respect that we are talking money. However, what you're talking about is less than one liver transplant, and as less than one liver transplant, and that doesn't include the care after that liver transplant. That's just for the liver itself,
yeah,
for one person. So I
absolutely,
there's definitely savings there, and treatment is cost effective, and screening people for hepatitis C is cost effective. The one thing I want to say is we've talked a lot about treatment here and services, but the vast majority of people with hepatitis C don't need treatment,
yep,
and don't need it immediately, but they do need to know they have it to stop the spread, and also for lifestyle issues, just as, you know, just one person stopping drinking alcohol can change the outcome of that disease for themselves. And so just getting that message across really can save dollars. There's a lot of things that can be done by identifying the disease early to save money in the long term, and the estimates are $85 billion in the next 10 years in direct and indirect medical care costs in the United States for hepatitis C alone, and that's an underestimation, but that is asterisked by if we can get the message out there about lifestyle changes and alcohol drinking with hepatitis C, if we can change that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes.
Madam Chair, if the diagnosis is early enough, they may never need any treatment at all.
Exactly.
Just lifestyle changes,
yeah,
all of this necessary.
There is a little bit in the way of figures. It's not in that report. I should mention it on Medicaid costs in Washington State. They've been going up pretty dramatically, but they're around $40 million now a year. Is Medicaid costs for the treatment of hepatitis.
Yeah.
In the Medicaid population.
In the Medicaid, just in the Medicaid population. We don't have good numbers outside that in the private health care in RENA. So.
Thank you very much. And we'll be bringing this bill back once we have a fiscal.
Okay.
Great. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming down from Seattle.
Yeah.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 520, and I'm going to open a public hearing on HJR 10. And we have, I had it on top. Where is it? Harley Ray, Jim Willis, Jeff Lightburn, because I want to get this out of the committee today.
Good plan.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Lightburn, and I'm here on behalf of the American Legion Department of Oregon. And as you heard from Representative Wisnett earlier today, some of the key highlights of the American Legion, and that we have the honor of celebrating our 90th birthday this month. And the Legion was actually formed in 1919 in Paris, France, and then was later authorized by Congress that same year. So what I'd like to do is just kind of quickly go through some other highlights, and they're in the written testimony that you have. As I mentioned, the American Legion was formed by a group of World War I veterans, and these folks continued to serve even after their successors fought the Second World War. Just as every generation of Legionnaires have served their comrades from all wars since. But serving fellow veterans is just one of the many ways that the American Legion serves our communities. The American Legion serves youth through outstanding programs such as American Legion Baseball, Junior Shooting Sports, as I heard one of the senators earlier, Boys State. And on the auxiliary side, there's Girls State. It's a leadership program. And Boys Nation. The American Legion has also supported the Boy Scouts of America, and since 1919, and today it charters 2,800 scouting units comprising of more than 74,000 young men and women. The American Legion High School Oratorical Contest awards scholarships to young men and women who can most effectively communicate the ideals of the U.S. Constitution. Now, this should come as no surprise, since mentoring youth is one of the key pillars on which the American Legion was founded. And our support has made a difference to recipients of the Child Welfare Foundation grants, which are used to educate the public about diseases such as juvenile diabetes and autism. Now, we've not forgotten these young people whose parents have made the ultimate sacrifice during the War on Terror. The American Legion's Legacy Scholarship Fund was created to help pay for the college tuition of those who lost a military parent serving since 9/11. Now, the American Legion does these things not because it can, because it's who we are. Our organization has been a driving force behind some of America's greatest legislation, and as you heard earlier, such as securing the passage of the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, better known as the GI Bill of Rights. But the American Legion hasn't rested on its laurels there, and even after that significant and historical accomplishment, we're still fighting, still serving, to increase the power of the GI Bill benefits, which have diminished over time. We're fighting for Congress to pass mandatory funding to guarantee that our veterans will receive the best care from the veterans' health care system. As the war on terrorism continues, more military men and women are coming home bearing the scars of battle. Many continue to recover from severe injuries, including loss of limbs, mobility, and psychological trauma. And some of these other bills and propositions that you're hearing today address those needs. And we're one of the organizations that support them. Through our Heroes to Hometown program, the American Legion works with the Department of Defense to provide these outstanding and dedicated Americans all the help they need to reestablish their lives when they come home. Now, another way that the American Legion supports troops is by assisting their families while they're deployed. Whether it's mowing a lawn or shopping for groceries, the American Legion's Family Support Network stands ready to assist those in need. Now, our national commanders, and Harley Ray, I don't know if he identified himself as such, he's the national vice commander for the American Legion. But our commanders have talked a lot about the value of membership, and they're not referring to hotel discounts and the monthly magazine that comes out or lunch specials at the post. Those are nice, but there's a lot more that goes on. The true value of the American Legion membership is displayed every day in the communities across Oregon and our nation. It's displayed on the American Legion baseball field, in a recently renovated VA hospital, or at a veterans memorial that was built with American Legion financial support. Now, I should have said at the beginning, the American Legion is comprised of nearly 3 million members, men and women who served in different branches of the military. Here in Oregon, there are 25,000 Legionnaires across the state that belong to 120 posts. That's the local unit level. In addition to that, the ladies belonging to the American Legion Auxiliary and the gentlemen belonging to the Sons of the American Legion, those are an additional 10,000 folks, remain in lockstep with our counterparts across the country and dedicated to continued service to our active military, including our National Guard members, veterans, their families, our youth, and our communities. Now, these 35,000 Oregonians are carrying out the programs of national scope that I described today on a local level. Additionally, our Legionnaires like to think outside the box and to improvise in other ways to help their local communities. Just to brag a little bit, Stephen Shute, Post 4 of Bend, for example, has worked with the Bend Area Habitat for Humanity to enable qualified veteran families to realize the American dream of owning a home. We're not in this for ourselves. We're in this for our brothers and sisters in arms. And we're in this for the husbands, wives, and parents of those who've served. And it's been since our founding, the citizens of this great nation and the state of Oregon know that when they call, American Legionnaires will continue to say, at your service. I want to thank you for allowing me to appear before you today and be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Ma'am.
Yes.
Senator Morissette?
Do you still have boys' state, girls' state?
Yes. The boys' state is driven by the American Legion.
I know.
And the girls' state through auxiliary. We do.
I went to boys' state.
So did I.
All right. Okay. And four of my eight children went to boys' state and girls'
wow.
state. And when I was teaching, I directed kids to boys' state. It's one of the very best programs I've seen.
And Senator Metzger also went to boys' state.
Wow. Heck of a deal.
Any other
Good
questions?
Job.
Thank you very, very much. Jim, Mr. Willis, do you want to say anything?
Well, Senator Morissette, in the interest of time, let me just say that the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs strongly endorses the support that we receive from the American Legion, and I should declare at this time that I am a life member of the American Legion. And I want to say, because Senator Morse is here, that historically the City of Albany's very first ambulance was purchased by the American Legion Post.
Really?
And the Albany Airport was created by the American Legion Post in the place that it currently is today. Mm-hmm. So these organizations have done a lot to vitalize our communities over the years. So I strongly support this resolution.
Thank you very much. All right. With that, please note for the record that Harley Ray was had to leave. He was in support of this bill. With that, I'll close the public hearing on HJR 10 and open a work session on HJR 10.
Madam Chair, I move HJR 10 to the Senate floor to do adopt recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves HJR 10 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered, and please note Senator Bates as excused. And I was looking at who's on the bill, and Senator Boquist will
be a good carry.
Would carry this bill. With that, I'll close the work session on HJR 10. And is Jim Booker? I want to quickly open a public hearing on HJM 2 to at least allow Jim to testify on that. Thank you. And then the rest of you can come back when we continue. And do we have time to carry these over or not?
To do what?
Carry these over to Tuesday or not? Will we have room on Tuesday? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Booker. I work for the Oregon Employment Department as the State Veterans Program Coordinator. I'm also a member of the Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services, and I am a veteran. In the interest of time, I do have a written statement here, and I'll very quickly, though, go over a few salient points for you. House Joint Memorial 2, among other things, advocates that the U.S. Congress provide more funding for the Disabled Veteran Outreach Program staff and for the local veteran employment representatives. Those two particular positions provide a great deal of support to veterans as they look for work. We are able, because we are veterans, to connect with veterans. We help them work through the system and the process of finding a job, which is not easy. Veterans are not always the best at promoting themselves to folks in the civilian world, and we're there to help them do that. We're very good at identifying things like the transitional skills that veterans bring with them from their military time, and also providing many important services that will help them in their job search. I'd like to note also that our connections with other service providers are very important, because we are often the first government that any of the veterans see. And so often when we're working with them, we discover they have other issues like health care issues, et cetera, and they need help with those. We are able to direct them to and connect them to the resources that they need. So we provide a very important service there also. Another thing we do is we identify gaps in services to veterans and work with folks like the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and the Oregon Military Department to make sure that those gaps are taken care of. Some of the things that we've been able to help out with is getting a job search transportation fund established for veterans a couple of sessions ago, the small business repair loans. We identified veterans that were having some issues, and Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs championed that. Also, the emergency funds that are available for veterans through the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and the Oregon Military Department. But we do have some problems. The The U.S. Department of Labor, Veterans, and Employment Training Service has not been able to fund us fully. We have flat funding over the past 5 years, but when you factor in the increased cost of operation, it's been, in effect, a cut. And so we've lost 5% of our funding over the past 5 years, which has resulted, though, in an 18% drop in DVOT staff, or Disabled Veteran Outreach Program staff, and a 45% decrease in local veteran employment staff. And yet the number of veterans that we need to serve is continuing to increase. I did attach some information on unemployment data, recent veterans unemployment data, and the number of veterans registering in the Employment Department Job Search Program, and you can see those numbers are going up, as well as the fact that we know that 3,500 or so Oregon National Guardsmen are going out on deployment and will be returning about 2010, and they're going to need help looking for work. What would we do with the funds if we were provided with more funds? We would make sure that we were continuing to support the Oregon National Guard Yellow Ribbon Reintegration Program. We would be continuing to work with the Oregon National Guard Family Program, which is a great way to get to the veterans and help them understand the various benefits that they have and make sure that they know we're here to help them out. The U.S. Navy and U.S. Army Reserves have recently really awakened to the fact that we're here to help them out, and they're beginning to seek out our services. So that's going to increase the need even more. We're also working with the U.S. Veterans Administration to create a training to help employers retain veteran employees.
Okay, Mr. Booker, unfortunately, we need to get to the floor, but you're nearby. We're going to carry over Senate Bill 606, HJM 2, and HJM 4 to next Tuesday.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And with that, I'll close the public hearing on HJM 2, and we're adjourned.